This is The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega. Over the weekend, there was another hate-motivated mass shooting in the United States. This time, the attacker was a self-proclaimed misogynist who left behind a trail of racist and sexist social media posts where he ranted about women, black people, and immigrants. On Friday evening, the gunman entered a yoga studio in Tallahassee, Florida, and shot six people, killing two. He then turned the gun on himself.
Two women died from their wounds, 21-year-old Mara Binkley and 62-year-old Dr. Nancy Van Vessem. Four additional victims were hospitalized. Police say the suspect is Scott Beerley. He had two previous arrests in Tallahassee, both for battery.
The gunman identified with the online incel community, self-proclaimed involuntary celibates, or men who say they feel wronged by women who reject them. It's at least the third high-profile attack by a so-called incel in recent years. In 2014, Elliot Roger killed six people in Isla Vista, California. Roger had a detailed manifesto and urged other incels to fight back. In one video posted to his YouTube channel, the Florida gunman expressed sympathy with Roger. Then, in April of this year, a 25-year-old man in Toronto, Canada, rammed a van into a busy district, killing 10 people and injuring another 16. This latest attack at the Florida yoga studio comes a week after a far-right extremist killed 11 people at a Pittsburgh synagogue. And days before that, a gunman in Jeffersontown, Kentucky, killed two black Americans in what's being considered a hate crime. And just days before that, an alleged far-right extremist mailed bombs to prominent Democratic political leaders. So how is law enforcement monitoring the online activity of these men who express hateful, racist, and threatening comments online? Are we taking these threats of violence seriously enough? Here to discuss all this is Heidi Byrick. She's the director of the Southern Poverty Law Center's Intelligence Project. And Julia Reinstein is a reporter with BuzzFeed News who helped break the story on the shooter's ideology.
He left a trail of what was clearly his beliefs. This man left a YouTube channel where he posted videos from 2014 and a SoundCloud account where he posted songs he wrote as recently as the day before. And these were some horrific things that were full of really violent misogyny against women, in addition to racism, homophobia, Islamophobia, a lot of anti-immigrant views, really just everything you could think of. But the predominant thing he clearly was thinking about is hatred of women. And it was all about how he couldn't get them to sleep with him or date him.
And that's Julia, that is part of the incel ideology. Can you explain a little
bit of
what that is and who these folks are?
Yeah. So the incel community is this group that they call part of the manosphere, which is kind of like associated with men's rights on the internet. And it means involuntary celibate. So it's men who can't have sex but want to and are so angry and frustrated at women because of that. But this isn't just men who can't have sex. This is such a specific group of men who hate women because of this. And they come up with all these rules and tricks for how they can hack their situation. And they were kicked off of Reddit, I think, last year, and now have kind of fled to these other smaller online communities that are a little harder to control.
And also, in addition to his online postings, Julia, you also found that he had been arrested twice for groping women.
Yeah, and it was particularly disturbing. So he had, I believe it was two separate charges for instances where he grabbed women's butts without their consent. And in the SoundCloud songs that I heard, some of which had been made recently, he spoke about wanting to do that. So this was clearly something that was part of something he really wanted to do and really drove a lot of his mentality, it seems.
Heidi, I want to bring you in here because you've spent a lot of your career researching right-wing extremists and hate groups. We're looking at this sort of intersection between right-wing extremism and sexism. What is that connection here?
Well, there's definitely a connection. The fact of the matter is that hate groups, sort of folks that call themselves part of the alt-right, have begun melding in recent years extreme misogyny, like this person exhibited, with all the other hate beliefs. So immigration, you know, anti-immigrant, racism, homophobia. In fact, nowadays, if you're talking about extremist groups, there's barely none that don't also subscribe in some way to this kind of extreme misogyny. And as you've already mentioned here, it's propelling violence directed at women now. So we don't just have extremist attacks on black people or gay people. We now have women in that same bucket of folks that are being targeted by people with these hateful views.
Heidi, what is the government or law enforcement doing to manage people who post these types of incendiary memes or songs or videos online?
Well, the problem is we don't know a whole lot of what the federal government is doing exactly when it comes to this. I mean, all of the incidents that we've had in the last week or so, including this one in Florida, there have been indications of extremist views that were posted openly online. But the feds have said they have more than 1,000 open cases against domestic terrorists, and yet we don't really know what that means. Does that mean that they're monitoring extremist posts on social media? Does that include lots and lots of neo-Nazis and white supremacists, or are these Islamic extremists? It's just very unclear what it is that the federal government is doing. And I'll also say the amount of this information, meaning hateful material online, is quite massive. So what you find are, unfortunately, so many people calling for the deaths of various minority populations or degrading women or others that I'm not even sure how they would, you know, they'd be handling this if they did. But we really need some clarity here about how seriously federal government is taking this threat, because the number of right-wing extremist attacks has been rising for some time. And this last week has been proof of exactly that point.
Well, and we've done reporting here on The Takeaway about the use of technology that many police departments around the country have, particularly for folks who are already in the criminal justice system, technology that can predict criminality, for example, that can predict a person's likelihood of being engaged in some sort of criminal activity. So I'm just struck by why it doesn't seem like we're able to apply those similar types of technologies to finding folks online. Maybe I'm wrong.
Well, there is a lot that could be done at the state and local level. And in some ways, those law enforcement agencies have more room to move than the FBI, which has certain strictures on what kind of information it can collect, going back to the time when they investigated people like Martin Luther King and John Lennon, and there were, you know, changes made to what could be, they call it an open case. You know, there was an article in the New York Times this weekend about white supremacists in Florida that talked to a local investigator who was preparing for a rally for an extremist, a white nationalist. And in that, it seemed that he wasn't able to get good information at the state level from anyone about these folks. So, you know, my view at this point is it would be good for Congress to look into exactly what is being done and how at the state level, at the local level, but also at the federal level. You know, we worry about terrorism, we should be protected from it, and it would be good to just know more about how this threat is being handled.
And Julia, let's talk about the companies who are hosting some of this content. There's YouTube and SoundCloud, and they both failed to remove the attackers' posts until after the shooting on Friday. And there have also been similar stories that have played out, like with Cesar Sayoc, the suspect who was arrested for allegedly mailing bombs to prominent Democrats across the country. Why do you think these tech companies are so slow to react, and should they be doing more?
Yeah, I think about this a lot in terms of YouTube and Twitter usually. They really love having a free speech mentality, which is, you know, a great thing to have until it's being abused. I think about Cesar Sayoc, and he had tweeted horrific racist threats at so many people for so long, and so many people said they reported it, and Twitter didn't really do anything. His profile was still up. When he was arrested, I was able to scroll through it. So it seems like these companies aren't really taking it seriously, and I think a lot of it is because this kind of abuse is so commonplace that it's easy to brush it off and think, you know, that person's not going to actually act out. I just came back from Pittsburgh. I have a very visibly Jewish last name. I get anti-Semitic threats all the time, but you don't usually think someone's going to do anything just because it's so mainstream now.
Heidi, what role does social media play in these types of attacks, and what role should these companies be taking on, you know, if law enforcement can't do it?
Well, look, the social media companies, whether it's Twitter or Facebook or YouTube, are really the place where change has got to happen. we have a situation now where you can spread disgusting propaganda to millions of people in just seconds. This isn't something the world has ever really seen before. You can radicalize individuals. You can draw them in. You can have these communities where incels or Nazis or whoever are. And we have had so many examples now. Dylann Roof, for example, who killed so many people in that church in Charleston, was radicalized completely online. There are many other examples. And if this material doesn't get taken down, we're just going to have more situations like we've seen in Pittsburgh, like we've seen now in Florida. And it's part of the reason why the Southern Poverty Law Center has joined 40 other civil rights organizations to provide a roadmap, actually a set of policies for these companies to follow to get rid of hateful activities on their platforms. There's just too much of it, and it's now metastasizing into real violence. It's not just people saying horrible stuff online, but they are literally being inspired to kill people because of this. And it's got to go. And the companies have just, they are overwhelmed, but they haven't done a good enough job of understanding that this stuff has to go, or we're going to have more problems like we've seen in the last week and a half.
Heidi Beirich is the director of the Southern Poverty Law Center's Intelligence Project. Thank you, Heidi.
Thank you.
And Julia Reinstein is a reporter with BuzzFeed News. Thank you, Julia.
Thank you.
Tomorrow is Election Day, and millions of Americans will decide the fate of the Senate, the House, dozens of governorships, and local races. And in at least 28 states, we're seeing early voting numbers far exceeding the 2014 midterm elections. Here at The Takeaway, we're continuing our coverage of ballot measures around the country by heading to California, where residents in three Bay Area cities will vote on measures that raise corporate taxes to fund services for the homeless. The initiatives have pit tech titans against tech titans as the region tries to solve one of its most difficult and systemic problems. Marisa Lagos is a political reporter for KQED, and she's here to give us the story. Hi, Marisa.
Hey, Danziana. Thanks for having me.
So we know this issue of homelessness is something that has affected the Bay Area. How important, and more importantly, how visible has it become?
Oh, incredibly visible. And, you know, it's really having an impact, I think, both on, you know, economic considerations like our tourism industry. And I think just generally people who live here are really fed up. It's not humane. I mean, it's very visible in cities like Oakland and San Francisco. There are tents with people living in them. We've just seen a spike in the sort of, you know, street visibility of homelessness. And then there's, of course, all those invisible homeless people like families who may be living in cars or doubling up on couches. I know that in some schools in San Francisco, there's been a huge problem with school children not having stable places to live. So I think it really has reached a breaking point, and it's something that pretty much everyone is looking for solutions to.
And let's talk about what the three measures are till tomorrow's election day. What's on the ballot specifically?
Yeah, so the biggest one I would say most controversial is Proposition C in San Francisco. This would tax revenue on companies that bring in over $50 million a year, and it would tax that revenue over $50 million a year. It's a gross receipts tax, and it would raise an estimated $300 million a year. That would double San Francisco's homeless budget. About half of it would go to long-term fixes like supportive housing, and the other half would go to things like shelters, mental health services, and rental assistance, things that are seen as more immediate. The other two are a little less controversial. Measure HH down in East Palo Alto would tax large office spaces at $250 per square foot, and that's for affordable housing. And then Mountain View has really set its sights on one employer, Google. It's a head tax on Measure C, so it would basically tax each employee, and larger companies would pay higher tax rates. And that's expected to raise around $6 million annually, and that would be used actually for transportation, which is kind of another issue that the housing and affordability issue has really laid bare is our transportation challenges here. And so you have people, you know, sleeping in their cars, maybe outside of Google. We had a big thing with like the bus drivers who couldn't you know, couldn't commute from the Central Valley. So they would sleep in the buses and then drive Google employees to work.
I'm talking with Marisa Lagos of KQED about ballot measures aimed at raising funds for homeless services. And Marisa, let's go back to Prop C, because you say that's the most controversial. So there's Mark Benioff of the tech company Salesforce and Dianne Feinstein and Nancy Pelosi on one side who are saying, yes, this is a good idea. But on the other side, we've got Twitter CEO Jack Dorsey and the new mayor of San Francisco, London Breed, who say they're against this. Can you give us a sense of why? I mean, given the size of the homelessness population in the Bay Area, I would imagine any and all attempts at fixing this would be a pretty straight shot, no?
Yeah, I mean, I think the opposition of someone like Jack Dorsey is more understandable. You know, he not only heads Twitter, but Square, which handles payments. And so they would actually be taxed at a much higher rate under this plan. I think Square is actually where Dorsey's concern lies more than Twitter. I mean, we've seen him, the Chamber of Commerce, a lot of other big companies, Lyft, for example, come out and put money to oppose this. And I think the bottom line is that the mayor's opposition has given them political cover to do so. And what she and some other folks in this, you know, very liberal town, but they are more moderate Democrats, quote unquote, say is that the city already spends $300 million a year. We need to do a better job of accounting for that money.
Well, I agree. I'll stop you right there. But the problem, I think, is so exacerbated, and you've seen this in your reporting, that it just stuns me that there is opposition to this at all.
I agree, especially because our mayor, you know, just won a special election after our mayor died last year. And so she'll be on the ballot in one more year. And so it is really kind of, I think it is head scratching to a lot of people, especially considering, you know, we trust City Hall in San Francisco with something like $11 billion a year. And folks who are opposing this are saying another $300 million we can't possibly trust them with. So I think a lot of advocates on the other side feel like maybe it's more political, like the mayor was not involved in writing this measure, and maybe she doesn't have ownership.
Right. And there's also the fact that rents have skyrocketed. It's one of the most expensive places to live in the United States is in the Bay Area.
That's right. And I think that's what advocates say who are, you know, pushing Prop C is like, look, you know, there's always this argument made, oh, we're going to become a magnet for homeless people. Something like 70% of the homeless in San Francisco were housed in the last decade. And so these are people who are losing their housing largely because of the affordability crisis. Of course, things like mental health and substance abuse also play into it. But I think what you're really seeing from folks like Mark Benioff, the Salesforce CEO, who has really stepped up philanthropically, he's coming out and saying, look, the homeless crisis is an existential crisis for Salesforce to stay headquartered in San Francisco. Paying a little more tax for me is not. And so he's really been not only putting millions of dollars behind Prop C, but sort of become their most vocal proponent. And you mentioned that's this interesting split because, you know, Dianne Feinstein is no, you know, lefty progressive San Franciscan. She's pretty moderate, but she and former Speaker Pelosi, House Minority Leader Pelosi, have really come in and said, look, something needs to happen. And so it has set up this sort of clash of not only the tech titans, but some of the most powerful politicians in San Francisco.
We'll be paying very close attention to see what happens between now and Election Day. Marisa Lagos is a political reporter for KQED, and she's also the co-host of the podcast Political Breakdown. Marisa, thanks again for joining us.
Always a pleasure, Tanzina.
And we asked you which ballot measures you're watching in the lead up to Election Day. Jackson Ludwig on Twitter brought our attention to Initiative 1631 in the state of Washington. The measure attempts to limit carbon emissions by taxing them. And the amount of money going into opposing this initiative, mostly from the oil industry, is making this the most expensive ballot measure in state history. To learn more, we've got John Ryan, environmental reporter for KUOW. Thanks for joining us, John.
Sure thing.
So tell us the basics of this ballot initiative. What is it really seeking to do?
It's seeking to boost the price of fossil fuels that cause carbon pollution in order to raise money for projects that would reduce that carbon pollution. It would start out by slapping a $15 a ton fee or tax on fossil fuels, which would work out to about 14 cents on a gallon of gasoline and other amounts on things like coal or natural gas.
And in terms of supporters of the ballot, who's supporting this and who's behind it so far?
It's really a product of the environmental movement and their allies. They spent a lot of effort this time around after a failure 2 years ago. They spent a lot of time building up a big coalition to make sure that they weren't having any internal infighting. So it's basically big environmental groups, groups representing communities of color, some of labor, and some businesses as well.
And who's on the flip side to that? Because we understand that there are, $28 million being funneled into advertising against the ballot measure.
It's already just bumped up to $31 million. It keeps going up day by day. And almost or more than 99% of that money opposing it has come from one source. It's the oil industry, a handful of big companies with names you might recognize like Phillips 66, Chevron, BP. They're funding almost entirely this effort to block what would be the first carbon tax or carbon fee in the United States.
So, John, you interviewed Cecilia Bitz, who's a climate scientist at the University of Washington in Seattle. And here's what she had to tell you.
The truth is we need to reduce dramatically. But the way we start is one step at a time, right? We need to be not producing any human sources of carbon dioxide within a few decades. And that's a very tough call.
What does she mean? I mean, at what point do we start? What is her concern there?
Well, I've also heard climate scientists say that now is the best time to start reducing emissions, but a better time would have been 30 years ago, that it's really a very urgent problem. And when she says we need to get down to zero, that's what the big UN panel, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, came out with their big, fairly alarming report a few weeks ago saying the world has to get down to zero emissions of carbon by the year 2050. And that would take unprecedented change to make happen. And the point of, I think, Cecilia Bitz there is that we have to start somewhere. The opponents of this measure in Washington State say that, well, yes, we agree that climate change is a problem, but we just think this is not the right way to go about tackling it.
I mean, is this really a big step, or would this be a big step toward battling climate change, or is it more like putting a Band-Aid on a broken leg?
I guess you could call it a more of a Band-Aid or maybe a baby step towards tackling a very big problem. It's noteworthy that that big UN report a few weeks ago highlighted carbon taxes as an effective way to tackle that problem. And the Nobel Prize for Economics this year also went to William Nordhaus, who is known for studying carbon taxes and their effect on the climate.
So if the oil industry doesn't want this solution, have they proposed alternative solutions given the urgency of that climate report and given the fact that this ballot measure is just a couple days away from being voted in or out?
In an interview I had with one of the main campaign, no campaign spokespeople, they refused upon repeated questioning to present a different proposal. In another setting, they did say, well, we would like to see government provide incentives or what I might call subsidies to help big polluters reduce their pollution. So instead of making polluters pay, the solution was to basically pay polluters to pollute less.
Hmm. Well, we'll be paying attention to see how this plays out on Election Day. John Ryan, environmental reporter for KUOW in Seattle. John, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Support for this podcast comes from Babbel. People around the world are learning new languages with the Babbel Language Learning app. And you can too. Learn Spanish, French, Italian, German, Russian, Swedish, and more with Babbel's 10 to 15 minute lessons. Babbel users say they're amazed at how fast they learned and that they are confident in speaking their new language. Start learning a new language today. Just go to babbel.com and use offer code TAKEAWAY to get 50% off your first 3 months. That's Babbel, BABBEL.com, offer code TAKEAWAY for 50% off your first 3 months.
You're never going to get to where you're going if you acknowledge fear. I think fear comes later when it's all over.
The voice of Marie Colvin, the late celebrated war correspondent. Colvin made her career working for the British Sunday Times beginning in the 1980s. She covered the horrors of war around the world for nearly three decades: Sierra Leone, Chechnya, Kosovo, East Timor, and Libya. And she died covering the war in Syria in 2012. Her story is getting new life again today with films and a book.
Marie was all about people, and she wasn't interested in the weapons of war, you know, the mechanics of the military, the kind of geopolitics of the situation. she thought the only way that you could show the true horrors of war would go to the places where the people who suffer the most are. And the people who suffer the most in war are generally the women and the children.
Photojournalist Paul Conroy traveled with Colvin for years, taking the unflinching, raw photographs that accompanied so many of her reports.
I think the results we were getting and the stories we were getting and the power of them was a combination of, you know, someone often said that the final story was often bigger than the two parts that were put in, you know, the words and the images. So it was just a unique way of working with someone that paid, that worked. I can't imagine going out now without her. You know, like I said, I still expect the phone to ring sometimes after a particularly bad attack and Marie going, hey, get your shit together, we're going.
I distinctly remember meeting her and being completely starstruck because she's a legend, of course.
Lindsay Addario is a photojournalist who has covered most major wars of the last two decades.
The hope for any of us who cover conflict is that we make a difference in policy. We show people what's happening in places where they are not able to access.
While covering the Sri Lankan Civil War in 2001, Colvin was struck by shrapnel from a grenade and lost sight in her left eye. After a difficult recovery, she started wearing an eye patch. It would become her signature. Many called her fearless, but there was another side to Colvin.
She had a lot of fear, and her strength was she overcame that fear and still managed to go in and do what she did. We'd be going through various zones. I always knew when she was feeling vulnerable because she used to go extremely quiet. She'd just sit and stare out of a window, and I knew that's when it was all racing round the head, you know, the concept of what we were about to do.
Despite her fears, Colvin insisted on getting stories of human suffering during wartime. Her final assignment was in Homs, Syria. In February 2012, she gave her last television interview to CNN.
It's a complete and utter lie that they are only going after terrorists. There are rockets, tank shells, anti-aircraft being fired in a parallel line into the city. The Syrian army is simply shelling a city of cold, starving civilians.
Marie Colvin, I know it's impossible to stay safe, but please try. Thank you for talking to us.
Thanks very much, Anderson.
Just hours after that dispatch, bombs struck the media center, killing Colvin and French photographer Remy Oschlick. Colvin was 56. Her friend and photographer Paul Conroy barely escaped with his life.
I immediately realized I had to get a tourniquet and I was losing a lot of blood. So I had a scarf, wrapped that around my leg. Yeah, I found Marie and Remy in the rubble. I checked Marie. And she was dead, and I could see that Remy was dead.
The quintessential struggle that any war correspondent, any photographer who covers conflict deals with is how long to stay, how far to go forward. You know, there is a line between what's relatively safe covering war and when you really go far and you're doing things that your other colleagues are not doing.
In the end, Colvin is credited as one of the first Western journalists to truly expose the extraordinary suffering the Syrian government was inflicting on its people. Today, Paul Conroy says he'd have a lot more to explain to Marie if he could talk to her just one more time.
I'd have to take her into a room, preferably a bar, buy her a drink, sit her down and, you know, break the news of what's not happened in Syria, what the world hasn't done. And then I think we just have to liven it up a bit and say, look, Marie, lots of people are saying wonderful, wonderful things about you. She was very modest, but she'd also love it, the fact that there's a, you know, a feature film being made out of it and a documentary and Lindy Hilsum's wonderful book in Extremis. You know, I would say, look, you're sorely missed, but you're not forgotten. And a lot of people are doing their best to let the world know about you.
You know, I really didn't want to create sort of a one-dimensional portrait of a war correspondent. That's not who she was. You know, it's so easy to castigate these people as, you know, adrenaline junkie, thrill-seeking wahoos. And that's about as far from the truth for her as possible.
Matthew Heineman is the director and producer of a new film, A Private War, about the life of war correspondent Marie Colvin. Rosamund Pike portrays Colvin in the film.
I hate being in a war zone. But I also feel compelled to see it for myself.
Heinemann usually makes observational documentaries where the action unfolds before your eyes. But in order to tell Colvin's compelling story, he created A Private War as a narrative, trying to stay as true as possible to her life. Something that helped him do that was the deep connection he felt to Colvin, who he'd never met.
In the docs that I've made, you know, I've traveled to Mexico and covered the Mexican drug wars and been in shootouts and meth labs and torture chambers and all sorts of places that you don't necessarily want to be in. I made a doc on a group of activists rising up to expose the atrocities of ISIS. And so I've felt that same draw to cover these conflict zones and that same bizarre feeling of coming home to New York the next day and going to a party. And so, you know, I very much empathized with her experience and just felt like it was, you know, a film that I had to make. I also, you know, in this world that we're living in now, it's quite important to explore and examine the importance of journalism in this world of sort of fake news and soundbites. And so for me, the film is not just an homage to Marie, but an homage to people out there fighting for the truth, you know, and exposing atrocities around the world.
A lot of people look at international war correspondents or people who are, or even regular journalists, you know, but particularly this type of journalism as adrenaline-seeking, you know, people who are just thrilled with this type of danger. And there's a much more complex portrait that you're trying to convey, particularly when it comes to her struggles. Can you tell us a little bit about how you portrayed her trauma in the film, like the nightmares that she was struggling with, the flashbacks, things like that?
Yeah, I mean, you know, some of these things she wrote about, you know, so we were able to pull on her own experiences and some of the her own nightmares that we had in her words, in her writing. Some of it, obviously, we had to use artistic license to try to, you know, get inside of her head and feel that pain. And, you know, that's some of those experiences are things that I've experienced. You know, I've had panic attacks. I've had images that I can't get out of my head from my documentary work. So, you know, in working with Rosamund Pike, who absolutely transformed herself into this role and did a, you know, phenomenal job in embodying who Marie was, you know, we would talk for hours often before shooting these scenes about what it's like to feel that, what it's like to go from this, you know, hyper-intense, hyperbolized world of war to the solitude of your home and that massive, massively divergent experience. That was something that was quite hard to personify in the film, but, you know, we at least tried to.
In the film, she resists getting treatment for her trauma. Why was that important to bring up? Why did you think that was her resistance to that was important to include in the film?
I think she was never able to really accept what was happening to her, what was happening to her mind, what was happening to her body. You know, she died at 56, but I think in her mind she was still 36. You know, and I think that's part of what the film is about. It's about that drive to continue to do your life's work, to follow your passions, despite every siren and every light and every person and every friend saying, stop, stop, stop. But she kept going. She couldn't stop, and she didn't stop. And ultimately, she paid, you know, the greatest price for that.
You mentioned Rosamund Pike getting into the role. Were there any other things that she did to really transform herself into Marie?
She was a big part of doing the research with me as well. I mean, you know, as we sort of went from friend to friend, you know, Roz was with me for a lot of that. And to see her, you know, approach all of these people almost as if Marie was approaching, you know, subjects for an article or a piece was amazing. And, you know, I think she sort of learned the process of being a journalist through a lot of that. She also transformed herself physically. You know, she's from London. She doesn't look a lot like Marie. So she had to learn, you know, this really unique Long Island accent that Marie had, which had a little bit of London in her, because she was an expat living there. And she had this sort of smoker's, you know, low voice. And then she also studied her physically. You know, she worked with a dancer to sort of examine how Marie moved and held tension in her neck and splayed her fingers when she, you know, gesticulated. And yeah, it was really incredible to see her transform into that role.
How do you approach the recreation of these war zones that Marie moves in throughout the film?
It was really, really important to me to try to make these war zones feel as authentic as possible. You know, we shot them all in Jordan. So Jordan was Sri Lanka, Iraq, Afghanistan, Libya, and Syria. And for weeks and weeks and weeks, we cast and found and interviewed refugees who are living there from the various countries. So when she's in Syria, when she's in homes and walks into the shelter, what's called the widow's basement, which is sheltering women and children, you know, the women were telling their own real stories, and those were real tears, and they're really from homes. You know, there's a scene afterwards in which a young boy is brought into a hospital, and his father was also from homes. You know, he was at a protest with his nephew, his two-year-old nephew, who was shot by a sniper bullet and bled out in front of him. And so when he came into that room, when he came onto that set, the trauma and the emotion that came out of him was almost unbearable for everyone. And again, those tears were real. And when he says, "God, why, that was him speaking. And I think, you know, Rosamund at one point almost couldn't handle it. And she walked off set and she said to me, you know, is this okay what we're doing? You know, the lines are so blurry. I don't know what, you know, is this a documentary? Is this, you know, I'm an actor. Like what is happening?
Like, is it exploitative?
Are we exploiting them? And I said to her, no, you know, this is what I do every day as a documentary filmmaker. You know, your human instinct is to give someone a hug or to give them space, but your job is to capture these moments. And the fact is that, you know, he wouldn't be here if he didn't want his story to be told.
Matthew Heineman is the director and producer of a new film about journalist Marie Colvin's life called A Private War. Matthew, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
If the record numbers of people participating in early voting this year are any indication, we could see a major turnout for Election Day tomorrow. But here at The Takeaway, we've also been focusing on another segment of Americans, non-voters. Back in August, we devoted a whole show to people who don't, can't, or won't vote.
I am a highly successful tax-paying citizen, 38 years old, and I have never even registered to vote. I don't identify either party is working on my behalf.
Not a Republican, I'm not a Democrat. If I find a party who supported the views as I see them, then I would vote.
What would make me return to the polls? How about some honesty? How about a modicum of morality?
The reason I don't vote is because I am so overly inundated with politics on a daily level that I have completely lost interest and would rather live my life and get on with it.
Americans do have a bad track record of showing up during midterm elections. In 2014, just 36% of those eligible voted, and that was the lowest turnout in 70 years. But this year, party leaders on both sides have been leaning on political heavy hitters, hoping to energize as much of the electorate as they can. Former First Lady Michelle Obama spoke at a rally in Las Vegas last month.
I get it. I get being busy. And I definitely get feeling frustrated. Because believe me, I am frustrated too. But here's the problem. While some folks are frustrated and tuned out and staying home on election day, trust me, other folks are showing up. Democracy continues with or without you.
And Vice President Mike Pence was in Georgia last week with a similar message.
I want you to decide right here, right now, if you haven't already done it, that you are going to vote. Remember, these elections are won by the people that show up. Friends don't let friends vote alone. Go out and find a family member, a neighbor, at worship, at work, and just, you know, grab them by the elbow and ask them, have you voted yet? And if they haven't, make sure they get to the polls before they close on election day.
And it's true that in a democratically elected government where power is decided by the people, there are consequences when those people are disengaged. And it's an argument that Roxane Gay, an associate professor at Purdue University and contributing opinion writer for the New York Times, makes in a new op-ed. And she joins us now. Roxane, it's always great to have you on the show.
Thanks for having me, Tanzina. It's great to be here.
So what led you to write the piece? You start this piece with an anecdote. Could you share that anecdote with our audience?
Yeah, I was at the University of Milwaukee. During the Q&A, a young woman who is actually a community activist in Milwaukee and does quite a lot of work in terms of immigration and sexuality and class asked me a question about disillusionment and voting. And I really understood her question, but as I told her a lot of what I wrote in my op-ed, because I just recognize that we're dealing with a really difficult time and a dangerous time for the most vulnerable among us. And we have a very flawed electoral system right now, but because it's flawed doesn't mean we give up on it and do nothing. And so I was just really motivated to say something to try and at least get some of these disillusioned voters to get off their asses and get to the polls on Tuesday.
And in particular, I'm wondering, are you talking about disillusioned voters who happen to be younger or disillusioned voters across the board? We actually did a show, an entire episode on different kinds of people who don't vote or can't vote or won't vote. So who was the audience, you think, for this message?
Anyone who's disillusioned. It was not relegated to a specific age group. I'm just deeply concerned with people who are disillusioned and think that not voting is an appropriate response to that disillusionment. Action is what always helps me when I'm feeling disillusioned. And quite frankly, right now, I am feeling incredibly disillusioned given everything that's going on. And I just can't do nothing.
It's interesting because Bree Newsom, who I'm sure you know, she says, you know, she feels like she was talking about the civil rights generation, sort of looking at comparing that to today. And one of the things that stuck with me was when she said, I feel like the civil rights generation, and I'm quoting here, because they were so violently barred from voting, better understood both inherent power of the ballot and the reality of how power functions. They knew they needed to secure vote and directly challenge white power structure at once. No choice. Do you think that she's right there? Do you think that the disillusionment is just a lack of understanding about how the power structure in the United States really works?
For some disillusioned voters, absolutely. But for other disillusioned voters, they very well know the sacrifices that were made to give women and people of color the right to vote, and they just don't care. And that's a very painful thing to confront. But I agree with what Bree said. I think that it's easier to appreciate the power of something when you had to fight for it than it is when it's something that you were given.
Mm. I mean, how are we supposed to get through to a disillusioned or apathetic voter? I mean, do we keep focusing on that group and saying, you should do this, you should do this? Or how do you even try to change the mindset behind that behavior?
I think that we keep reminding them of what's at stake. I think that many of them have created some intellectual distance between their lack of motivation to vote and the very real atrocities that this country is facing and that the most vulnerable Americans are facing. And so I think when you have that distance, it's up to us to close it for them if they won't do it for themselves.
There are lots of people who will say everything from, you know, they feel disillusioned by the process, they feel disillusioned by attempts at voter suppression, they feel disillusioned with the outcome. You know, they may not be happy with the outcome and therefore they don't want to participate in that. Is there any empathy from your end for any of those reasons?
Oh, I have a lot of empathy for, you know, any perspective that someone has, but I have more empathy for people who are being disenfranchised and who are being denied their birthright citizenship and who are being murdered. You know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. That's sad. Like, I understand that. But like, as a Black woman in this country, I feel wildly disillusioned about all of the things that matter to me that are not being addressed by this government. But I'm still going to vote. And I'm not particularly rah, rah, rah. You know, I'm not the most positive person in the world. I still feel this responsibility. And so I think that at some point, and I wrote this in the op-ed, you have to get over yourself a little bit. And recognize that sometimes we have to make decisions for the greater good. The reality is that we are living in a world with other people. We share this planet and this country with other people. And the better we are to each other, the better everything is because, you know, just many hands make light work.
I don't think there's ever been a midterm more interesting than this one.
Not in my lifetime, and certainly not in my voting. I started voting in 1992, and this is by far the most interesting midterm election and the one with the most at stake.
I have to say, I've been voting for around the same time, and I would have to say I agree. Roxane Gay is an associate professor at Purdue University, an author of Hunger, and a contributing writer for The New York Times. Roxane, thanks so much for coming back on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Tomorrow on the show, as voters across the country head to the polls, we are going to take a look at how Americans are getting more involved in their own communities by doing everything from attending town halls to educating their fellow citizens to volunteering. So we want to hear from you. Are you more engaged with your community now than in the past? And if so, how?
This is Mike in Highland Park, Illinois. Since I retired about a year ago, I've been volunteering with the local high schools and the local library. I feel more a part of my community than ever before, even though I've been living here for 35 years.
This is Rachel from Elkins Park, PA, an inner ring Philadelphia suburb that is a bit of a progressive bubble. I really love that right now and find that engaging within my local community and my synagogue community helps me feel more balanced, connected, and hopeful. And I need that right in this moment.
Keep the calls coming. Our number is 877-8-MY-TAKE. You can also send us a tweet. We're at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.